Hey, y'all, this is Matt.
And Michelle from Thug Kitchen, here to tell you about our new show, Borked Up, a Thug Kitchen podcast exclusively on Podcast One.
We're stepping out of the kitchen and into your earbuds every week to discuss food, politics, pop culture. Basically, we're just trying to give a f***ing do better.
Get your shit together with us every Thursday on Borked Up, a Thug Kitchen podcast, right here on Podcast One.
Download and listen to new episodes exclusively on PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
Thanks, y'all.
Hey, and welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. As always, check out the folks that support the program at drdrew.com. We appreciate it very, very much. And our friends at Hydrolite and our friends at we got a whole bunch of friends. But please help them help us. And we are very privileged to have with us today Joyce Maynard. Joyce, welcome to the program.
I've been looking forward to talking with you.
I've been looking forward to talking with you, too. This is going to be very interesting. The new book is called The Best of Us. It's available on Amazon now. You can follow Joyce at Joyce Maynard, MAYNARD.com, or follow her on Twitter at Joyce Maynard, the usual spelling of Joyce. And if you don't mind, I'd like to – well, the book is about the demise of your a recent marriage.
My marriage didn't die.
I'm right. The husband did.
The marriage was healthy.
The marriage was – I was trying to think of a way of saying it was a new marriage where the husband died.
Yes. And actually, I think of the book as as a love story, but it's a love story set against the background of a catastrophic illness, which was pancreatic cancer.
And I heard you say something rather striking, which was that you wish you didn't have to get cancer to learn about cancer.
If only we could get the letters,
yeah,
the lessons of cancer without cancer, which is part of what I hope to convey in this book.
Yes, and definitely worth your reading for that very reason.
And I want to say, too, just by way of introducing the book, that Jim and I were both had been on our own a long time, mm-hmm, when we found each other. This was not a young marriage. We had been married young and had three children and had been on our own, each of us, for about 25 years when
each other. Oh, that's interesting.
And so we never took it for granted. I was 57. He was 59.
And one of the things that struck me about your statement about I wish I had cancer or to learn about cancer – as a physician, I had a very strange reaction to it because on one hand I thought, oh, but there are a million emotional lessons that people always talk about that there's no other way to learn other than having, you know, being there or being a family member of somebody with that problem. But as a physician, we have been there a million times, and yet people don't want to listen to us.
It's one of the reasons why I was looking forward to talking with you, Drew, have written a book that is about a journey through a relationship and a marriage, but also a medical journey and, mm-hmm, a kind of a medical thriller in a way. I mean, I scoured the globe for a way to save my husband, and there's nothing that I don't do pretty fiercely. So I lived, you know, with a phone on each ear trying. And it astonishes me how few physicians have engaged in the conversation with me over the few months since the book has been published.
I
sent
it
to all of our doctors. I mean, it's not for me to tell you how doctors are, but I don't think doctors like to fail. And of course,
we fail all the time. Cancer, you get pancreatic cancer, that's death. That's the 6-12 months. Boom.
But you know, for instance, I mean, I'm jumping ahead in the story a little bit, but you get this diagnosis. In our case, it was 15 months after our wedding and about three years after we'd met.
You said something incredible. You said when you went back to get the diagnosis, you're like, oh, don't let this be gallstones.
Yes, exactly.
Like, wouldn't you give anything
for
it to be gallstones?
They tell you, you know, it is definitely a post-traumatic stress moment
that
you walk into this room and the whole world changes in an instant. And the doctor sort of puts his hand on your shoulder and tears came to his eyes and he said, you know, my father died of this, like you will too. And then he says, there's one way that you might possibly survive, and it's a surgery called the Whipple procedure.
Blech.
But you probably aren't even going to qualify for it. And even if you do, the cancer will probably come back. Yeah. But to people in that desperate situation, all you hear is, we've got to get the Whipple procedure.
Yeah, I know.
And I became, and of course we weren't, you know, medical experts, but I brought myself up to speed as well as I could. I called every medical team, every pancreatic
team.
This
is the zone that makes me absolutely apoplectic.
And this is why I wanted to, you know, speak in this particular forum,
which is when you give people, they can't, the 1% is, you just don't even hear 1%.
Right.
You have to help them make the decision. And then, thank God, yeah, I thought to myself, in your store, when your surgeon who did a nice job with the Whipple, which I wouldn't do that to my worst enemy, that procedure.
No. He called it a successful surgery.
And 36 out of 38 nodes were negative.
Yeah.
And they always end that with, got it all, got it all. And 95% of patients hear that as, you cured it, we're all done.
Yeah.
And the surgeons just leave that. They leave it there. Thank God you went, wait a minute, there's two nodes that still has cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get going. Let's get going.
Which led to another problem, of course, that we went too fast.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a minefield, this territory. Yeah. And, you know,
It's why most physicians would go on a long trip and then take a big dose of something when they get diagnoses like this.
I will tell you that I love my life and I hope I have a long one. But if I got a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer tomorrow, unless somebody could give me a very particular argument for why this procedure made sense for me, I would say no, thank
you. Absolutely.
I want to say for the, you know, one person who might be listening who is going for this, there are very particular situations, and you probably know better than
I. Well, let me paint one for you. Steve Jobs had exactly that situation. His life could have been saved by something similar to a big procedure like
the
Whipple thing.
He had a
neuroendocrine tumor, and his can be cured
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is alive, thank God, as a survivor of pancreatic cancer that was detected when she went in for something.
Accidentally. And again, it's way down in the tail or something, probably. It's a different
But I want to say, I mean, I don't, the book is not ultimately, although it's very tempting talking with you to just get down to, you know, I became a student of pancreatic cancer and a student of doctors and the medical world as a person who'd never spent a night in a hospital until that moment. But I had my babies at home, even. I just stayed away from doctors and hospitals. But ultimately, what I wanted to explore was something more than cancer. Mm-hmm. I wanted to explore marriage. And in our case, it was the experience of navigating this brutally hard landscape.
And this is what I hear from cancer patients frequently, is that their relationships become intimate in a way and intense in a way that nothing else had ever given them.
Even as all the things that I thought I wanted were stripped away. You know, I was sort of addicted to romance, and I found it in Jim. He was just a gloriously smart, funny, handsome, debonair man. He could have played James Bond in a movie. On my website, I created a little movie of the two of us. That it's a little 3-minute thing that sort of shows us over the course of our relationship, and also what that cancer did to him. He was a trim man to begin with, so there was nothing much to lose, but he went down to about 85 pounds. I didn't quite show the end because that I thought was more brutal than anybody needed to see. But all of the trappings of what I believe constituted a love affair were taken away, you know, the sort of candlelit dinners and trips over the Golden Gate Bridge to, you know, go into San Francisco and go dancing. And what was left turned out to be the thing that mattered the most.
Which is?
Being truly known by somebody, feeling totally accepted by somebody, not in your most heroic moments necessarily, but although there was great heroism in Jim, in the way that he approached his illness and his death, but this, I felt greatly honored to be allowed into this very intimate place with him.
Well, feeling felt, they say, and feeling known is a similar phenomena, is thought to be the most important territory for people.
Yeah. It was what he said. Probably the last day that he could speak. He said a friend came to see him and said, "How are you doing, Jim?" And he was obviously dying. He said, "I'm doing well. I feel that I have been known."
Wow.
And I got to be known too. I was known. And now, that doesn't go away when the person does.
That's true. Do you want to describe that?
Yeah. Jim died 18 months ago. The loss is very much with me. I actually had in my possession a set of tools that were pretty unique to address it, which is that I could write. So I started writing this book the night Jim died. Actually, he died in the middle of the night, and I just lay down there next to him for about an hour because I knew I'd never have that experience again. And then I went downstairs. It was too early to call anybody, his children, my children. But I opened my laptop, and I began to tell this story.
Right then.
That night. It's what I do. It's what I've done all my life. But what remains is, and what I wanted to capture, and I feel very proud of that I have captured, is what a good relationship looks like. Not a perfect relationship. Had he lived, I'm sure we would have had our struggles that we didn't have the luxury of going through. I want to say to people who, you know, who are having trouble in their marriage, you have a living person to work with. What a gift that is. But that endures with me, and it I carry it into the future.
Now, you've said addicted to romance.
Yeah.
And the arc of your life includes some evidence of addiction to romance and some relationship issues that weren't as clear and intimate as this particular relationship.
Introduce me to a 64-year-old who hasn't had a few relationship issues.
True, that's true. But if you don't mind, I'd like to bring it from the all the way forward from early in childhood, where your dad was an alcoholic, right?
Yeah.
Severe alcoholic, it sounded like.
My father got drunk every night. Significant almost than that is the fact that every morning we pretended it never happened. And when I talk about the experience of growing up in an alcoholic family, which I do because I think it's one of the formative experiences, maybe the formative experience of my life. Mm-hmm. It was an extraordinary family in many ways, deeply inspiring family. My parents have been dead for decades, but they're very much with me. But when I talk about that experience, I identify two very distinct hard things about growing up in an alcoholic family. And one is that the person you love gets drunk, and you can't stop that. And the other, in my case, was, and it's true for so many people in alcoholic families or families of some form of substance abuse, that the keeping of the secret,
right,
which for a child creates this extreme sense of shame, this what did I do wrong, and terror of the secret being found out. And I attribute that experience to my own choice as a writer for most of my life, not all of my writing life. I've been publishing my work since I was 14, 50 years this year, but for the vast majority of the years I've been writing, I feel an absolute commitment to give readers nothing less than the truth, and not to leave anybody reading my work feeling the way I used to feel, that I was the only one out there. So I've gotten a lot of heat for this, that I've been called the queen of oversharing. I talk about things that some people don't talk about. And that's very intentional. I feel able to. It doesn't, for me, the most disturbing experience is not talking about something difficult. It's having something difficult going on and not talking about it.
In addition to keeping secrets, the alcoholic family also has certain roles that become very characteristic. There's a hero, a scapegoat, and all those kinds of
I was
stuff.
The mascot.
The mascot, okay.
Yes.
I was wondering which one you were in.
I was the one to make everything okay.
And use writing as kind of a way to do it?
I was, both of my
you were
parents
carrying their
were
crucible, right?
Brilliant, yeah. Talented artists.
Were they college professors or something?
My father was a college professor and a painter.
Were you up at Dartmouth or where in New Hampshire?
University of New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
My mother had a PhD from Harvard, Radcliffe in those days, but as a wife and mother of the 50s, couldn't get a job. Mm. Sold encyclopedias door to door. And onto me, onto my shoulders, fell the responsibility to lay at their feet the acknowledgement and success that had eluded them.
Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer, and today over a million people use the amazing Ring video doorbell. They can protect their homes with this. You know how it works. Security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. So now they are extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Awesome. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects right to your phone. With HD video and two-way audio, that lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. And then you can see and speak to them, even set off an alarm right from your phone. That's right. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you will immediately know what it is and where it is and talk to it. Whether you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on your home. Ring Floodlight offers the ultimate in-home security with high-visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands. And you can save up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com, R-A-N-G, ring.com/Drew. That is ring.com/Drew to save $150. I don't know how we do this, but go there. Find it at ring.com/Drew, D-R-E-W.
I'm pleased to welcome Hydrolite back to our program. Hydrolite is not only a product that I can safely recommend, it's something that I use all the time. In fact, I have some sitting in front of me right now. It is the best oral rehydration product I have ever tried. In one event, the same thing myself, and they got there first. And I was sick this week, and I'm taking Hydrolite. It keeps me hydrated as well as anything better than any way I can possibly get hydrated. This is it. And at this time of year, it's impossible. Everyone's getting sick, right? They knock you down. Staying hydrated is a crucial part of it. So even if you manage to avoid this, obviously if you get it, it's crucial you take Hydrolite. But if your schedule's half as busy as mine, then staying hydrated is also important. Getting those 8 glasses of water in a day is almost impossible. Beauty of Hydrolite is whether you're sick or not, you can benefit from the proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. And Hydrolite does this better than any sports drink and certainly better than water alone. Comes in great flavors, orange, berry, lemonade, and is available as a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or my personal preference is the effervescent fizzy tablets. Simply drop in the water. I then dropped it in a bottle of water today, by several of them, in fact, and I've been drinking it all day. Compared to sports drinks, Hydrolite delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. Come on now. Hydrolite solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. You can find Hydrolite at Rite Aid or online at Amazon.com. And for a limited time, my listeners can save 30% on Hydrolite. Get some now. Just click the banner on my website at drdrew.com and use the code DrDrew18, D-R-D-R-E-W-18 at checkout. That is drdrew.com. Click on the Hydrolite banner, and then the code is DrDrew18. So you had to – we also had to be the hero then too, right?
Yeah, there was some of that too. I have a sister, but she turned down the job offer.
Oh, yeah.
So very wisely, I'm the younger one. So yes, it's the person who's going to make them happy and fix it that way. And I began publishing my work.
14.
Well, I began crazy. Actually – if you count Humpty Dumpty magazine, even younger. But before I could even write, my mother was taking dictation on my stories and mailing them in. And we didn't play sports in our family. We didn't go to games. We didn't have barbecues. We wrote. And it's not how I raised my children, but there was no way that you could emerge from that household and not know how to write well.
And this is where J.D. Salinger found you, was when you were writing for one of these magazines as
a
teenager.
Well, when I was 18 years old, mm-hmm. in my freshman year at Yale, I took a bunch of my clippings. I was a very shy girl, and I was not a worldly person. I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire, but I was bold about my writing. I knew I wrote well.
Is it Hanover? Where were you?
I was at Yale in New Haven.
No, I mean in New Hampshire.
It's a little town called Durham.
Durham.
Mailed my clippings to the editor-in-chief of the New York Times with a letter that said, I'd like to write for you. It's the kind of thing you sort of have to be 18 years old to do. And interestingly, he wrote back and said, okay. And he gave me an assignment to write the only story I was equipped to write, which was the story of my life, my growing up. This was 1972. And I wrote my story. They sent a photographer to take my picture in my blue jeans at the Yale campus. And about 3 weeks later, there I was in full color on the cover of the New York Times magazine section. And this was 1972 when we had so much less media. You know, there were three channels on TV, and there were a handful of magazines that everybody read, and that was one, at least on the East Coast.
And the written word had – I want to talk with you about this because people don't understand the history of the written word in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
It was a 6,000-word article that, you know, that people still had the attention span for. And literally 2 days after that article appeared on the cover of the New York Times magazine, there was a sack of mail on the doorstep of my college dormitory room with about 1,000 letters, including offers, everything that my mother ever wanted for me, offers from magazine editors and book editors and TV producers and radio producers. And, you know, if you'd been around then, it would have been you. An invitation to audition for The Exorcist and model clothes for Mademoiselle. And in among all of those letters, everything
that's
my mother ever
crazy
dreamed of.
Crazy little ripple there.
And
wow.
For a small town girl from New York, for any girl from New York. Incidentally, the article was called, and I totally missed the irony of this, An 18-Year-Old Looks Back on Life.
Oh, wow, that's funny.
I didn't look beautiful in the picture, but I looked real.
You looked of the time.
I had no makeup on. My hair was kind of a mess. I was wearing, you know, kind of ratty blue jeans. But in among those letters was one very different one saying, typewritten, single spaced, "Dear Miss Maynard," I'm not quoting exactly, but close, "I want you to know that I read your article on Sunday and I think you're a real writer. And I'm sending you words of caution and warning because I know something about the dangers of early success and you will be exploited." Kind of ironic words, as it turned out. And he went on to say, "I bet you're sitting in your college dormitory room now, surrounded by letters from editors of magazines and book editors and people wanting you to model clothes for Mademoiselle and audition for movies and every single thing that was happening." So already I thought the author of this letter is
clairvoyant.
Magic. Yeah. Has some ability to understand me and my life, my, you know, my secrets.
Again, it's hard for people to – let me restate this. It's like, you know, people don't understand, like, getting called to the couch on The Tonight Show if you're a comedian. The next day,
yes,
your life is different. This is the same thing with the written word.
It was.
Certain publications if you're in, New
and
Yorker.
Honestly, my greatest ambition was not to be a famous writer. Although my parents had raised me to be that, mine was to know a happy life because I hadn't known that, to be part of a happy family. Mm. And here was this person who seemed to know me as nobody else did.
The author of The Catcher in the Rye,
I get to the
Salen.
Bottom of
and
the
you,
page.
And you, of course, had read his books and things.
No, I hadn't, actually. I had not. I was a TV watcher. I wasn't a reader at that point.
What?
But I knew.
But
so
a writer,
I,
but not a reader. That's crazy.
I might have been more impressed if I'd gotten a letter from John Lennon. But it wasn't his name that impressed me. It was what he said. And we embarked on a correspondence that obliterated everything else that was going on in my life. And when school ended that spring, that June, the first thing I did was to go visit this man that I perceived 35 years older than I. He was 53.
So he was grooming you for that year.
I didn't see it that way.
I understand, but that's grooming behavior.
I saw him as my mentor, my teacher, my friend, my spiritual guide. And he saw it differently. And within a matter of weeks, I had given up my full scholarship at Yale and my job at the New York Times, cut myself off from my friends, mostly my family. Moved in with him, believing, that I would be there forever and that he was the only person who understood me and loved and knew me. And a year later, I wrote my first book there, ostensibly a memoir, although I never mentioned in that 160 pages that I came from an alcoholic family or that I, the youth spokesperson of America in 1972, had dropped out of her Ivy League college to move in with J.D. Salinger. And about 3 weeks before that book was due to be published, I didn't see the connection then, but I certainly do now. He, on a trip to Florida with him, he put two $50 bills in my hand and said, "I want you to go back to the house and clear everything out. I don't want to see you again." And said a bunch of other things that if any man said them to me now, I would think considerably less of the man.
Like what?
That I was a shallow person who pursued the empty, meaningless attractions of publication and fame. That I was a lightweight. That I.
And you're stuck in a car with him. While he's doing this,
we were on a beach in Florida, actually, with his two children, who were just a little younger than me.
Oh my God!
And I went by myself back to New Hampshire in the winter, and cleared my things out, feeling that I had failed. That's what an 18-year-old girl thinks. I was 19 by that time, actually. Oh. And for the next 25 years, although I carried on with my life, I am a resilient person and a survivor. So I continued to publish work. I married an age-appropriate man. I divorced an age-appropriate man. In between, I had three children that were very appropriate. But for 25 years, I did not tell that story out of a sense of obligation to the great man.
Ugh.
A sense of obligation that I have to say, even in this Me Too era, many still seem to believe I violated.
Are you kidding me?
At the age of 44, when my own daughter, my oldest child, turned 18, I suddenly, it was a real flashback experience.
Mm-hmm. It happens.
And I had always viewed the story in terms of what was owed to the great man. And I couldn't have recognized what I deserved. But when I saw Audrey, my daughter, in the position I had been in, my loyalty shifted to her. And
was she exploited by somebody? Or?
No, not at all. And she never would have been.
But you were just identified with her.
I saw an 18-year-old girl in that position.
A child.
And I gave myself permission to tell this forbidden story.
Is it in the documentary about Salinger?
I was interviewed in that documentary. I don't have a high opinion of that documentary, but I do appear in it. But what I did was I wrote the real story. And somewhat naively believed, this was 1998, that once I explained what my true experience had been, my story would be understood. It wasn't an act of vengeance. It was just, I believe, you know, everybody has a right to tell their story. Salinger was still alive at this point. I had actually gone to see him in an attempt to speak to him about this. He shook his fist at me and said some pretty terrible things that actually did not hurt me at 44.
Like what kind of thing?
He said the problem, he didn't invite me into his house. He was almost 80 at that point. I stood on the doorstep. I'd knocked on his door. And I said, I've come to ask you a question, Jerry. What was my purpose in your life? And he spilled out a lot of invective, but then he pointed his finger at me and he said, the problem with you, Joyce, is you love the world.
He hates it.
So I went home. That freed me, actually. That liberated me. I had lived in fear of his judgment and sought his approval for a very long time. But I then wrote a memoir that became my book, At Home in the World, which was published in the fall of 1998. And I wish I could tell you that, you know, the kind of response that we are now seeing to women coming forward with their stories took place in the fall of 1998. Quite the contrary. Every major publication in the country condemned not so much just the book, but me personally. There was an editorial in the New York Times called me a predator, an exploiter of this person who just wanted to be left alone. The critic from Time magazine said, the one good thing about Joyce Maynard's book, At Home in the World, is that now that she's told the one story of significance that she has to tell, we will never have to hear from Joyce Maynard again. And of course, those were sort of fighting words.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And I've published, I think, 9 books since then. But that book continued to be a really forbidden book. It's not a book that's in the canon of memoir. It's had a little resurgence in the last few months.
I was going to say, are people coming around?
People are actually. I'm really curious to see. This will be the first cycle of publication since all the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. This next month, and I'm curious to see. But it seems as if stores are selling that book again.
I do not understand why people are not clamoring to interview you, because it's so.
Well, they're just not all as smart as you are, Drew.
No.
Or they're not all as smart as Michelle, who got me on the show.
Yeah. but this is deeply meaningful. These are the guys that we want called out and brought to the surface. The guys
it's a very clever and predate form of manipulation.
It's
grooming and if you
behavior.
Possess the skills of J.D. Salinger, then that letter that you send to the girl will be basically a letter from Holden Caulfield, which is what my letters were.
And I'm sure it's what you heard.
That's what it is absolutely what I heard. There's a postscript to this, which is that the year after I published At Home in the World, I decided that I had no further need for those letters.
Mm.
About 60 pages of handwritten and been typed, in a few cases, letters from Salinger. And I decided they actually weren't love letters, incidentally. They were kind of pedantic. They were about writing and Zen and music, jazz and baseball. But I felt that I had no further need for this record of a very unfortunate history that had taken away a lot of my youth, or that I had allowed to take away my youth. And so I put them up. I consigned them to Sotheby's to be auctioned off. And I really hoped, if I'd been independently wealthy, I would have just given them to the Library of Congress or Yale University. But they were put up for auction with the hope that some university would purchase them for their collection. It was actually the biggest single document of Salinger that had appeared in 20 years. There was an outcry in the press that Joyce Maynard was selling her love letters now. Look at that shocking woman. What will she do next? And the man who ultimately did buy them, a very wealthy man, returned them to Salinger. However, since then, in the aftermath of that, I have probably heard from about 50 women, some a few years older than me, some a few years younger, who also have letters from Salinger.
See, I think we need to do a new New York Times article with you on the front and the entire arc of this.
Well, I'm happy to say that although I tell this story to you because I needed to catch you up a little bit in the last few decades, but I don't, it's not my objective to spend my life with this story. And I was very happy, actually. The new memoir is almost a bookend to the old one because it is the story of a good relationship.
I get
a
it.
Good man.
And for you, I could not be happier. But for women generally, this needs to be somehow processed,
metabolized. Believe me, I'm always there. In fact, anytime I give a speech, a condition is that copies of At Home in the World be present so that women can give them, women and men, can give them to their daughters. It's a book I dedicated to my 18-year-old daughter, Audrey.
Because I even yesterday somebody told me, well, I had a relationship with a teacher, but I really wanted it. I'm like, no. You're that age, you don't know what you want.
Know.
He's grooming that. He's manipulating that out of you. And his job, even if he were to do that and unknowingly create the attraction, his job is to hold the boundary. That's his job.
Yes.
It's about power, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is.
And misappropriation of power.
Yeah. And in the case of me and Salinger, I was actually, and I think he was very skillful in recognizing who the girls were. I mentioned, my daughter would not have gone.
Did you talk to
like
these
that.
Other women, the 50?
They almost every one of them came from an alcoholic family.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, brushing your teeth is a very important part of your day and your overall health. And at Quip, they know, and they've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of the bulkier traditional electric brushes. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsick. They've thought of everything design-wise. It's a great product. And because it cleans your mouth the way it should be cleaned, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule. They deliver new brush heads every 3 months for just $5. That includes free shipping worldwide. And Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals. It includes dentists, hygienists, dental students. Most toothbrushes do not get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. So it starts at just $25. Go to getquip.com/Drew right now, and you'll get your first refill pack for free. That is, again, that first refill pack for free at getquip.com, Q-U-I-P, getquip.com/Drew. Not Dr. Drew, just Drew. Getquip.com/Drew. Diabetes increases your risk of heart disease and high cholesterol. You really should know that. I'd be surprised if you didn't, but if you don't, be aware. February is American Heart Month. Be proactive about your heart health and talk about your risk factors for heart disease and high cholesterol with your physician. Your medical team can work to create a treatment plan that fits your lifestyle and lowers your risk for high LDL cholesterol and heart disease. Take control by knowing your numbers. Get tested for glucose levels, blood pressure, and cholesterol. For more information, visit womeningovernment.org. That's womeningovernment.org.
When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. A lot of times that is not the case. People configure cars online only later to find out they are not available. Not with TrueCar. Of course, I'm talking about TrueCar. You get real pricing on actual inventory. This is not pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing from an actual dealer. And not just any dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. This is a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Yeah, you know, and we talk about all the time. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. Next, TrueCar, TrueCar.com or TrueCar app will show you what other people in your area paid for the same car you're looking for. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. Over 3,000 TrueCar Certified Dealers are available nationwide. You will get to work directly with a TrueCar Certified Dealer that you make contact with, and TrueCar users are more likely to enjoy a faster, better buying experience when they contact a TrueCar Certified Dealer. And on average, you can expect to save over $3,000 off MSRP. Once you register, you'll see a real price on actual inventory. Hook up with that TrueCar certified dealer. Have a better buying experience. TrueCar, go to the TrueCar.com or TrueCar app. Do what I'm telling you.
So he just knew he knew his targets.
Yeah. And it wasn't that I even mentioned in my New York Times article that I came from an alcoholic family. Of course, I was still in my shame place. Interestingly, the one word that was used most consistently in the reviews, almost always negative, of At Home in the World, yeah, was shameless.
God, meaning, damn it.
I'm so angry.
This is not, you need to, this is an important piece of history
to
help us
understand.
Do
you have a daughter?
I do, yeah.
I suggest that you give this book to her.
I will. She will be, well, she may actually call you because she's a nonfiction writer. That's what she does.
And how old is she?
25.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And she's out in New York and stuff. So.
I don't want to suggest that older people can't read this book, too. I think you do fine reading this book. But, and it's, you know, sometimes when I go somewhere, people will say, oh, you're the one who wrote the book about Salinger. Ugh. Well, actually, no. I wrote a book about me, and Salinger chose to be a part of my life. And it is a very odd phenomenon at the age of 64 that a man that I last saw fleetingly at age 44, but never spent, you know, any time in his company since age 19, has continued to be an element in my life, just about every day of my life. For those first 25 years, I didn't speak of him, but I was always asked about him. It was known, and I was very loyal, and I don't speak about Salinger. And frankly, I'd rather talk about other things, but I understand your concern.
I'm trying to understand the Me Too movement as thoroughly as I possibly can. And unless you understand this kind of history, it's hard to really place where we're going.
And I have some frustrations with this because I really did hope that the Me Too movement would be somewhat retroactive in ways.
It needs to be. It really needs to be. Because I think there's a lot of anger that's built up from somewhere, and this is a perfect – he essentially was a cult leader. That's what he was doing, right? 50 women in a cult. They intemporally across time spread out, but still it's cult BS.
Yeah. And none of this, I should say, you know, I'm not the anti-Salinger here. You know, those books are the same books they always were, you know, and you can love the books. And, you know, I don't think we have to believe that Pablo Picasso lived the most exemplary life with women.
He was horrible.
Yeah. But
he was terrible.
I know it. And I will always go to the museum to see Picasso.
Well, but this is what we have to reconcile is like who – we don't take paintings off the wall because they're a misogynistic domestic violence a-hole. But we have to figure out what we do with it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
people are losing things in the current time
that,
for lesser, far lesser problems.
Yeah.
It's disturbing. But let me switch gears a little bit and talk about writing generally.
Yes.
People today do not appreciate that in the 50s, particularly, when the written word, the novel, the poem, that was the highest form of that was the top of the mountain.
Yes,
everyone wanted to be a writer the way everyone would want to be a movie star, say in the 70s.
And they read, memorized poetry,
and talked about it, and you know, your status was determined by who you were reading, what you were reading, what you thought about it. I mean, it's particularly in New York, the whole scene was about reading and writing and poetry. What was that like? And then what's happened?
Well.
Is it coming back?
You know, I'm not an old fogey here. I appreciate modernity and everything, you know, not everything that's come down the pike, but all the, you know, there's a lot new that I celebrate, but the degradation of language I do not. the other day, I'll give you the actual context of this. There was a man who was courting me in this sort of, you know, post my widow position. And he kept on sending me these texts. Very nice man.
This wasn't Tinder. This is actually text.
These were text messages.
No pictures.
Emojis of flowers and butterflies. And he was such a nice man. I finally had to say to him, you know, I love flowers and I love butterflies, real ones. But pushing a button to show me a little emoji of a butterfly or a flower that you didn't draw, that is in no way from human hands, does absolutely nothing for me. I grew up, it was an old-fashioned household in some ways. My parents, between the two of them, had most of the Western canon of literature, and in my father's case, the Bible, committed to memory, and spoke it, and had those rhythms in their voices. And it's, you know, that's gone. There, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. But I'm holding the line as best I can. I mostly write. My profession, my career for my whole adult life has been this odd thing of writing books. But I teach on rare occasions. And when I do, I only teach memoir because I want to help other people tell their stories. And I hold whoever I work with, usually not people who are going to go on to be professional writers, to a standard of language that I believe in, that honors what the word can do.
Well, I was just thinking about this man with his emoji. Thank God he spared you what most men send pictures of.
And you know, so. And I felt I had to tell him because I didn't want to be irritated anymore. And I liked him, but not that way. But anyway.
Do you think it's coming back, writing? Do you think the written word is going to have some sort of resurgence?
Oh, gosh.
Probably not like it was, but who knows?
I mean, you know, I don't I never attempt to make these sort of big, broad statements. I'll just speak of my little world. I'm holding the line the best I can. I'm a storyteller and I'm a writer, and I want, whether I'm writing a novel, which I often do, most of my books are novels, or a memoir, I want to hold you gripping that book so you can't put it down. Mm-hmm. I want to keep you up all night. I want the sound of my words to be to be a beautiful thing in your ears or in your head. I love recording my books. I do all my own audiobooks because the sound of language is something. If I could, I would be a singer. And since I can't sing well, that's my music.
What's your favorite book?
My favorite book of all the books ever.
Or you can give me a couple.
Oh, gosh. No, I can't give you a couple.
A few?
No, I won't.
An author?
I won't even
an
go
author?
There. Okay. Well, it changes constantly, but I'm rereading Raymond Carver right now. I love the spareness of that language. I love the absolute honesty and authenticity of every single second in those very short stories. He never wrote novels, and he wrote poetry. But on any given day, it would be a totally different answer.
Do you like Hemingway?
I do like Hemingway. I'm
that economy of language.
Yes, economy of language. It's a little bit more of the sort of the cult of the male, you know, thing.
Yeah.
So it doesn't speak to me in the same ways.
Right.
The women of Hemingway don't get to me the way the women of Raymond Carver do.
You know who a Hemingway character that I thought was great was it Pietro or Piero? Pierre, the woman that in I think it was For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Ah.
And she is like she's essentially a underground. It's during the Civil War, and she's an underground leader essentially. Her name translated as Rock.
Yeah, I know what that means.
That was great.
You see, now I'm going to make a shameful admission. I've never read because I've never read For Whom the Bell Tolls because I'm a college dropout.
That makes me so mad that he took away your
and
education.
I could have still read that book.
Yeah.
Right? That's no excuse.
And when you say the word, I think, of course, we're talking about English.
Yes.
Is there
I love French. I love Spanish. I love language.
Do you speak other languages?
I do.
Okay.
And my books are published in French. In fact, I'm going to tell you the title of this new book in the French because it has a totally different title. And I'll say it in French because I love to say the French and I'll tell you what it means. It comes from something that my husband Jim said about 6 weeks before he died.
So it's unrelated to the original, your English title.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. The English title is The Best of Us. The French title is Un jour tu raconteras cette histoire.
Which a day means, to tell a story.
No, one day you will tell this story. Which Jim knew me very well.
I like that. How come you didn't do it in English?
It's very French, but yeah, I love that title.
Yeah.
And he always knew. Jim was a very private man, but he totally endorsed my – he knew I would tell this story. I wanted it to have a different ending. But and that's why, as I said, I started to write it the night he died. That's what I know to do is tell stories. And I was raised for it in a boot camp, really.
Meaning?
My parents.
Meaning,
you know,
a dinner table and things like that?
Dinner table, breakfast table, on my walks with my father, always.
Just talking
always.
About books.
Talking about language, listening to poetry, memorizing poetry, talking about ideas, yeah.
Now, I hear three or four different phenomena there. Talking about ideas is sort of more like philosophy.
Yes, and I mean, my parents celebrated conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You could have taped us. Actually, they did one night. They just put a tape recorder, reel to reel, you know, under our dinner table, and keep in mind, this is a household where, you know, we talked about art, music, politics, religion, sex, even. Never the thing that was actually happening. But they were brilliant.
Would he drink at the dinner table?
No.
He'd go upstairs to the attic.
After, to the attic.
And what time was that?
Early. My father was a painter, and he was a really wonderful painter.
Would he paint up there while he drank?
He would paint all night long.
Paint and drink.
Paint
and violent?
Drink, and no, no, no. And I would go up and look at his paintings, and we would talk about the paintings together. He was, you can actually Google his name. His paintings are, he at the very end of his life, he was discovered as a painter in his 70s, but he painted in total obscurity for most of his life. Max Maynard is his name. And he died when I was 27, but he's very present in my daily life because his paintings are all over my house.
And aside from the fact that it's scary to see your parents intoxicated, was there some other behavior that he manifested?
No,
so just this persistent.
No, he was not violent.
Isolation.
He was sad, and that's almost the worst because I couldn't make him happy, and I tried so hard to do that. I was funny. I danced. I sang. I did goofy routines, but I couldn't fix it. I was his. He called me chum. I was his sidekick. And I was with him all the time.
That's the mascot piece you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems very painful.
Yeah. Many people have painful family stories, and I'm
but
one.
This is painful for you, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's okay. Yeah. These are human experiences.
I fully own it. My approach to painful experience tends to be dive right in the middle of that wave and swim around in it and then go and talk about it.
So mad at J.D. Salinger. So mad at him.
I hope I haven't ruined these books for you.
I'm thinking about going back and reading some stuff just to see what I can pluck out about his psychopathy.
Well, you will see. If you, you know, if you're alerted to this, you certainly do see the celebration of young girls. And, you know, everybody has his or her story. And there's a reason why I think he was sort of trapped in adolescence as he grew older and older. It's one vision of hell, you know, to still be fixated. I mean, really, the problem with me, the reason I had to go, apart from the fact
you grew up.
I grew up, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
so did he?
I was too old for him.
Did he go with any under 18 children?
No, I think he was very careful that way. I now know, because I've heard from so many of these women, that he was writing letters to other girls while I was with him, believing that I was the love of his life.
Of
he was
course.
Certainly the love of mine.
This guy needs to be called out a little bit, but I just feel like it's important in the context of the conversation we're all having about Me Too. I can't put it all together yet, but there's something important there connecting that, because I've always felt like there's very much a lot of what's going on now is some anger built up that started in the 70s, where women bought a bill of goods in the 70s, the bill for which is coming due now.
Yeah, but we're talking, I mean, at home in the world, the book about Salinger
yeah.
was published in 1998.
No, I understand, but you still, know, your experience and
yes,
whatever has accumulated. Is...
I feel a double trauma, and I don't even want to use that word trauma. I'm a high functioning person. I raised my children. I paid the bills. I do what I need to do, and I feel like a pretty strong woman. But took care of my husband well. Mm. But there was the initial experience with Salinger that happened when I was 18. There was the 25 years in which I lived, labored under the impression, although I was working as a writer, always publishing books, working as a journalist, I was at the New York Times, that I could never tell that story. And then there was this triumphant release of, okay, I get to tell the story.
Because again, it's more secrets with
yes.
you.
Yes, and then secrets. I published that book, I'm now 44, and slammed down, really just...
Yeah, re-traumatized.
Yeah. So I guess that I do, you know, that's probably a bit of a sensitive point, you know, and that's why...
Are you afraid it's going to be, again, you're afraid...
No, I'm not afraid. You know something? I'm afraid of just about nothing now, is the, really
good.
The truth.
Yeah.
What more can they say about me? When this new book was published, a very well-known critic for The Atlantic published a review of the book. I was excited. I thought, oh, The Atlantic is reviewing my book. That's really great. Because often I'm not sort of respected as a true writer. I'm that person who, you know, exploited Salinger.
Oh, my God.
Sort of kiss and tell person. this in spite of publishing 17 books. Mm-hmm. The title of The Atlantic piece about me, ostensibly about my book, but it was really me once again, was The Queen of Oversharing.
Oh, you said this, yeah.
So it was once again, there goes Joyce Maynard talking about her life. I don't know whose life I should be talking about, if not my own. I don't think you'd want me speculating about yours.
I told you, my daughter is in a graduate program where this is all they do.
Yes.
Nonfiction, creative writing about their lives.
And of course, it doesn't mean you say what you ate for breakfast this morning. It is a serious exploration in what it meant, where it took you, what your particular journey was. But I know, and I do not give advice. I don't tell people how to live their lives. I put mine out the best I can, and leave it for the intelligence of the reader, and boy, do I have respect for the intelligence of the reader.
Well,
I've
got pretty good listeners, and I want them to tweet you at Joyce Maynard. I've rarely given direction to my listeners, but I'm telling them right now it's at Joyce Maynard, and show her some support and your thoughts, and you know, it's has got to strike you the way it strikes me, everyone listening to this, that there's a historical moment here we're all living through, and it started right about with you on the front page of that magazine. I just feel an arc from there. And if any of you are relating to the stories, if any of you have read her books and appreciate it, just put it out on Twitter and tag her at Joyce Maynard, M-A-Y-N-A-R-D. I don't think you quite appreciate where this fits in what's – it was a pretty intense time we're experiencing right now.
Oh, no. Yeah. I appreciate. Believe me.
And
I get it.
I think you're
I didn't
part
miss it.
Of it.
I yeah. did not miss it. I have been sort of holding up my hand and waving, saying, hello.
And you were a victim not only of a cult leader essentially, but you're also a victim of the male patriarchy that then attacked you when you tried to speak up. And that's the part
I
agree.
And I have to say, Drew, that when I hear that word victim, I kind of – I flinch because
you're not
I
a
don't
victim.
Want
you weren't
to
a
be.
Victim. I understand.
But
you were the – I don't know. Let's think of a better word for it. You were the object of scrutiny
yes.
by a patriarchy that treated you not just unfairly but horribly. And it's at least – And apology is not enough. Just let's put you in the historical context of what we're dealing with here, and really, as we try to understand where we're going with the Me Too thing, which I'm deeply interested in trying to figure out, because I don't understand why we let athletes and rock stars off the hook, but then James Franco maybe does something. I don't know. Maybe no. They won't tell us, and he should lose everything. It's like I don't understand the logic of
well,
what we're
about
into here.
Letting presidents off the hook.
Yeah,
President,
yeah, listen,
singular,
and Bill Clinton. And there's a lot of them. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of people, it seems a little. It seems illogical, but there's got to be a logic to it, and that's what I'm trying to understand.
Concern that I have is that it's still very it's selective. You know, the movie stars can go out and talk about it.
That's right.
But the secretaries in the office, are they, do they feel?
That's the question.
Do they feel able to complain about a boss? Do, you know, the medical workers, do the,
or does anybody
the
listen?
Domestic workers, do the waitresses?
I don't feel like you've ever been listened to about your 1998 experience. Have people really heard what you went through?
No,
yeah. I mean,
actually,
that's insane. Yeah. I hear you.
You know, I'll tell you a story. You know, there are certain memoirs that are you know, known. You know, everybody, you know, if you ask their favorite memoir, they all name, you know, Glass Castle, you know, Frank McCourt, whatever. And mine is never on that list. But I learned that there was one professor, one college professor in the United States who was teaching at home in the world.
Okay.
And she actually wrote something about the intense discussion, you know, because there was a lot of controversy amongst her students. This was a few years ago about, you know, whether I had a right to tell this story.
Whether you had a right. It's your story.
And so this was a professor.
Whether you had a right.
This was a professor at Yale.
Okay.
And so I wrote to her. And I said, if you would ever like me to visit your class, I will. This is the sort of thing I've been doing for 20 years.
Yeah.
I figure, okay, at my own expense, I'll get on a plane, I'll fly to I'll get to New Haven, and I'll talk to this class. So I did that. But the one class that I have ever heard that studies that book, and that's true.
Did you go? I go every year.
Oh. Every year I go. And I'm almost just sort of doing it on a person by person basis.
Has the conversation changed?
I never anymore encounter young people in that class who don't think that I had a right to tell that story.
It's bizarre.
And it's your story.
Yeah,
and it's now, I'd like to think that it is now a different generation. They are appalled. But actually, it has some lasting reverberations. And one is that a book that I was deeply proud of, am deeply proud of, has not been read.
Which one?
At Home in the World. That book.
I'm confused. They're not even starting to now?
Well, as I said, I'm very curious to see what's happening in this current cycle.
I think it
never has been. I'm going to make a challenge to your reader, to your listeners.
I make sure
if you go to Barnes & Noble, or I hope your independent bookstore, and ask for that book, they won't have it.
I hate to say it, but Amazon will.
Amazon will.
So they're probably going to Kindle or something too. But I'm anxious to read it now.
Good.
And is it still sort of that 18-year-old experience that you're looking – I mean, what's your perspective as you're writing that book? Is it an adult?
No. I wrote it – I actually wrote it in the first person of all the different ages that I was. It goes up to age 44.
Mm-hmm. And you're able to get that perspective?
I'm pretty good at that. Mm-hmm. I end it actually with my visit to Salinger the fall of 1997, on the eve of my 44th birthday, when I knocked at his door.
I had a weird preoccupation with him as a young person.
Well, many did. What do you think? What was the source of it for you?
The mystery. He he seemed like a cult leader. And I didn't realize that's what I was responding to, but in retrospect, it was that kind of – and I always liked the books and stuff. And I liked the short stories actually better than the
– I think the short stories are the real masterpieces.
But I may have to go read them. And it was the characters I liked. You know, and they were quirky and weird and very much.
And
at the
I'm
time.
Not going to say anything bad about Salinger as a writer. You know, those books are extraordinary books. So, some more than others, I think. And it's a very small
lexicon.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna look at him again now with an eye towards his psychopathy and what I'll be pulling out of there, because I'm sure it's in there. Not just the glorification of young female. He also has to have a real. There has to be a problem. He must have been sexually abused or something, and that's why
I have never believed in that it was my place to speculate on the cause. I try to stick with what I know. I see myself almost like a documentary filmmaker in that book. I'm going to give you the footage and then let you interpret. I never use any labels of you know, who I think he might be, but I do talk about his extreme preoccupation with World War II, and in which he fought, and he was in fact in some very hard places to be. He was in a rehearsal for D-Day that was a brutal experience. And the story, I'll tell you a little story that you probably know the story for Esme with Love and Squalor.
Yep, sure.
And there's, as you may remember, there's a very emotionally damaged soldier who meets this young girl, lovable, charming, innocent,
young
girl, Esme, abroad. And she's wearing a watch. She's wearing a very large watch. Well, on the cover of the New York Times Magazine section, I was wearing my watch. And it's the kind of watch I've worn all my life.
Oh,
I'm wearing one right now. I wear a man's watch, very large. And I was very, very skinny, so my watch was always flopping around on my
wrist.
Somehow
that's his.
So the face was pointed out. And in his, the first time I ever met him, he didn't say this in any of his letters, but the first time I met him, which was June of 1972, when I hitched a ride up to Hanover, New Hampshire, and he picked me up in his BMW and swept me away. He said to me, he took my wrist and he said, "You're wearing the watch."
Blech.
I do still wear a big watch.
It's nice. You're entitled to.
I don't think about him when I wear. I just like a big watch.
I'm thinking about what it was for my generation, that why he was, in addition to his sort of mystique and all this stuff, but he glorified the damaged adolescent.
Yeah.
He really gave us a voice, and we all kind of feel damaged.
The damaged, privileged adolescent, should be said.
I would agree with you, and that's probably why it related to me as a white male and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Esme was not really privileged, was she?
No. I'm speaking about the boy.
Caulfield for sure.
Yeah.
But some of the other characters, like Ray's Hot, being carpenters and things, they were not privileged folks that I could recall. But there are a lot of young people that we're feeling understood by those characters.
Yes.
And it wasn't the best in us. It played out in not a great way either.
But it is one of the things that people say about Salinger. You know, I felt he was the first person who understood me. And that's exactly what I felt reading that letter.
But it was a time, it was such a, I hate the 70s. It was just such a time of.
It was some great music.
That's what people come back at me with, the music and the film, and just watch The Deuce. That's what the 70s felt like. Well, Joyce, listen, I've got to wrap this up. It has been a sheer privilege to talk to you, and I hope this has been fun for you.
I hope that your listeners will go to my website and
They're going to tweet you. That's what I asked them to do. They're going to tweet you, and then you tell them to go to the website.
Then you
guys go get the book, and let's all go read At Home in the World.
And The Best of Us, please.
And The Best of Us, for sure. Those are all assignments for me. Follow Joyce at Joyce Maynard, and go see her at joycemaynard.com, and we'll talk again. Okay?
Sounds good.
Thank you so much.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.